We'll roll right into item three, a presentation from staff and Invesco regarding potential commitment to the Invesco U.S. Real Estate Fund 4. Chi-Chi, Tim, good morning.
Morning. So a little bit more real estate before we get off that topic for this year. We recently had board level discussion about the funds we had available to commit to private real estate. We identified at that point in time about $175 million available for commitments. The board has approved commitments to Angela Gordon's opportunistic fund and to Oak Tree's opportunistic fund. And we said there would be a little bit of value add money that we have identified as well.
Is that your new ringtone?
I don't know, baby. Call the question.
So in that memo, we identified a small allocation to value add. We said we'd be with one of our existing partners. Invesco is back in the market with Fund 4. At this point, we've invested with the last several funds with varying degrees of success, but in our underwriting, we do think they're on better footing now than they have been in some of their funds in the past. And we've identified a $35 million recommended allocation to Fund 4. I'll let Chi-Chi walk through the actual logistics of what we're looking at here.
So Invesco is one of our three value-add managers. We have been their investor since Fund 1. If you look at page 2 of the memo, the table in the middle. At the time we committed Fund 1 and Fund 2, you had a much shorter roster of real estate managers. So the commitment amount were larger at that time. Right now we are recommending $35 million to Fund 4, and this is to maintain our current level with Invesco exposure. Fund 4 is target $500 million for its fund size. It had already closed $140 million in June for the first close. There are other LP capital line up at the various stage of the due diligence and approval process. We don't see any problems, the fund will be able to close. The fund has a 9% preferred return. That means they have to return our capital plus 9% interest annually before they can participate in any upside. Fund will invest in two types of asset. Majority, 60 to 70%, will be in broken core. So you can think about this as a sort of a fallen angel, fallen angels in gateway cities. Where they, after they fix the asset, they can sell the asset into abundance of the core buyers in those market. And the rest will be underpriced commodity. These are not hard to replace asset. So in order to invest, to invest, they have to meet their pricing criteria. The fund has already closed one transaction, $30 million transaction in San Francisco. Jeff and I, we actually went there and toured the building. Interesting enough, for your information, Invesco is the only managers in our real estate lineup that has significant, meaningful exposure in a very tight San Francisco office market. And we asked them, you know, what's the reason for that? Is it because they have a lot of core funds? But they told us it's because they have boots on the ground. So they really have the people go out looking for transactions locally. The fund, the building actually has very good news lately. In early October, one famous internet company signed a 10-year lease to take 6 out of the 8 floors of the building with option to lease 100% of the floor. So according to Invesco, this would probably represent 1.5x investment multiple for the fund. On the firm side, we saw Invesco become a stronger entity after the financial crisis, especially in 2011. They acquired the Real Estate Investment Group out of AIG's Asia. This acquisition really catapulted the company into the global playing field. They picked up human capital and the LP capital from Asia. This is very good development. for our existing funds, Fund 1 and Fund 2 were kind of scarred by their commercial real estate, CMBS, commercial mortgage-backed security investment. In Fund 3 and the fund in the future, they would no longer be able to invest in CMBS.
Yeah, and it's important to note that Invesco is not the only one of our real estate managers that got burned by CMBS exposure. We saw that phenomenon in DLJ as well. It was, I think a number of real estate managers saw an opportunity set there, went after it, and realized that being a good real estate manager does not make you a good debt underwriter. And so we've seen the pullback there.
Yeah. But on the real estate side of the investment, they have held reasonably well. I actually went to Dallas, spent 2 days there after they were put on watch, just to go over their books, compare their actual performance to the projections. I came away satisfied. The firm is very net operating income driven, very focused on exit. If you look at page 4 of the memo and page 6, if I can think about one chart about Invesco, this is probably the chart that I would relate to them mostly. In Fund 1 on page 4, you can see at the beginning of the financial crisis, they got rid of bad assets quickly and then focused on stabilizing the net operating income. The navy blue bar is the net operating income. The sky blue line with the square, little square, those are the number of the assets they held. And the green line is the distribution. So after the financial crisis, they were able to sell the asset and give a lot of capital back to us. On page 6.
That was Fund 1, right?
Yeah, that was Fund 1. We only have one investment left in Fund 1, and they will be sold this year and into next year. It's a public stock, so they try to sell it in an orderly way, not to let the market know they have a large position. On page 6, this is Fund 2. Fund 2 has less investment done prior to the crisis, so they were able to gross the number of assets as long as the net operating income. We will get a lot of distribution back for the rest of this year and the next year. Fund 3, when Fund 3 came out initially, we did not invest in Fund 3. We waited until they told us, they did what they told us they would do on Fund 1 and Fund 2. And more importantly, at the time we commit to Fund 3, there are already several transactions closed. So we got a great look into the portfolio before we commit.
Yeah, we really took a long pause on value-add investments post-crisis. It was a difficult segment of the marketplace to be in because you're basically taking an in-place asset and improving it slightly and then delivering it to the, broadly stabilized asset to the core marketplace. If you don't have core buyers, there's not a lot you're going to do to improve capital appreciation. You can have a good strong income stream, but you're not going to improve capital appreciation. So we really wanted to see that investment thesis borne out. And you'll recall that we committed to Fund 3, we committed to Long Wharf, we did all that in 2012. So there was about a 3-year soft period in there for value add before we legged back into it.
So overall, Fund 1, we should be able to get our money back. Fund 2, we would have probably some profit, probably IR in the high single digit area. Fund 3 should be a very successful investment. And we are seeing this momentum being carried into the Fund 4. So what does $35 million commitment in Fund 4 give us? I'd like to just quickly illustrate this in this chart. So this is the risk and return spectrum of your value-add managers. After the financial crisis, we introduced LaSalle into the value-add lineup. So out of the three managers, LaSalle is probably the most conservative one. So we allocate probably 50% of the value-add with LaSalle and let Invesco and Long Wharf split the other 50%. Lone Wolf is more edgy, more on the high risk, high return side, very close to the opportunistic sector of the real estate managers. Not to forget, we have opportunistic manager here and distressed manager here. So we saw it's prudent to have LaSalle as an anchor with 50% of the capital in value allocated to them. And for risk of the fund four, we talk about it internally, and we think the major risk is the regional economy. For example, in San Francisco, technology, internet, we don't know how long the hot trend will continue, so it's hard to say. But again, if you look at the pipeline of Fund 4, they don't have other investment in San Francisco area. This is the only one they have.
The other thing that's important to note when we're talking with our managers, we're basically asking them how they're underwriting these assets as they acquire them. And I think we've heard without fail, and Invesco included, that they're basically saying, we don't think we're going to be able to get out at the exit multiples of today's market. We're underwriting a softening in the market, and then we're seeing if we can still make our numbers. So that's that kind of prudence is what we're looking for here.
Question. Who the question really is, who are the buyers in the strategy? And what I'm trying to figure out is, are the ultimate exit strategy buyers the same for broken core and distressed and value added? Is it the same group that you expect to be there to have the buying power to make all of those investments flip?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a value chain that everyone tries to buy an impaired asset, improve it, and sell it on to the next level down. And the ultimate is a prime asset, a prime location, fully leased and throwing off cash flow. And that's what we call a core asset. You know, an office building in Midtown Manhattan, an office building in downtown San Francisco, a multifamily in the East Bay. These are prime assets. So really the ultimate buyer is always going to be the core market. Now, you could take a distressed play and improve it slightly and sell it to a value add who's going to take it the rest of the way and then sell it to a core. That is a value proposition as well.
Is that actually a vibrant market? I was trying to figure out if this is linear. In other words, if you looked at it and said, okay, this at the bottom, the distressed real estate, you know, sells to the next chain and then it gets gobbled by the next one and the next one. But it doesn't seem to work that way. It looks like the core market is the predominant.
Yeah,
buyer.
I would say everybody's ultimate goal is to get the core pricing because the core pricing is the most aggressive pricing. The core buyers want to hold cash flowing asset and therefore are going to be willing to pay the highest price for it. If you can actually get your asset up to that level and deliver to that market, that's the highest value. If you can't get it all the way, you might pass it off to the next player who will improve it the rest of the way. These guys are going to be selling into the core marketplace. So it's predicated on having a vibrant core marketplace.
Right.
The core marketplace has been incredibly strong in part because fixed income yields are so low. And income is so scarce in the investable universe today that anything that's throwing off a steady income stream is in demand. There's a lot of buyers for it. So there's been a lot of crossover from people who would normally be in debt allocations buying more core real estate because it's got a steady income stream associated.
So it acts like a really good fixed income.
Right now, there's crossover between those two. Normally, it's throwing off a higher income stream. It's been bid up where, you know, people are paying a higher price for the same in-place cash flow, so your yield is compressed, but that yield is still superior to what you're getting in the fixed income market.
So the risk here is that the forces that drive core real estate in a New York or San Francisco market get impaired. Something happens like what we had in 2000.
Right? Yeah, I'd say if you had rates rising 3 percentage points overnight, we're going to have a problem here.
I just remember in 2000 in the Walnut Creek market, all of the dot-comers who, you know, it was a big thing of pride to how much money you lost and your stock would go to Pluto, right? And then the whole thing collapsed. And they were bidding rents up. They were like $450 a foot in my building in Walnut Creek. It's like, are you kidding me? And then overnight, building was renegotiating everybody's leases.
Yeah.
But it was because of that driver. So I look at San Francisco, just in this local market, you know, the tech, boom seems to be just completely fueling that. I've talked to refugees from the city who are who can't rent a one-bedroom, right? Can't rent a studio. Right. Frustration. They're all in the East Bay, right? They're hitting the Oakland market and so forth. And I don't know how long it sustains.
Well, I think San Francisco is going to be at the extreme end of what these guys are doing.
Right.
They are
the number one office market right now in the nation.
The number not one office market.
Office market.
Wow.
They're going to play in San Francisco. They're going to play in New York, but they're not going to have some of the dedicated allocations that our opportunistic managers would have in those spaces. They're going to leg in when it's appropriate. So we've got one office building in San Francisco. As Chi-Chi said, it's fully leased with a 10-year lease on it to a credit tenant. Is it at a high rate? Yeah, it's at a high rate. But, you know, that's a building that's going to be relatively easy to sell on to a core buyer in today's marketplace. The risk to the thesis is in 4 years, we don't necessarily know what that core marketplace is going to look like here. But we do foresee extended periods of low interest rates, and that's kind of giving us a little bit more guidance that the core buyers and the strategic buyers are going to remain, at least in some of these prime markets, are going to remain at elevated levels. We don't know the future.
No, I know.
But we're basically saying like, things are really great right now. What if they get less great? Can we still make money? And that's what we're underwriting here.
Yeah, sure. And one thing worth mentioning. Oh, John.
Well, part of it's a follow-up to Scott's question. It sounds to me like the building we're talking about is the Twitter building on Market Street.
You can't tell us what building it is?
Not on public record.
Oh, all right.
The Twitter?
It just sounds like it. Okay, if it is, without confirming any of that.
You can ask the Invesco guys. If they want to disclose it, I'll let them disclose it.
I was just going to comment. The reason that they did it was the Board of Supervisors gave them huge tax subsidies that no other corporation gets. That's how they got to this higher standard, this core standard. That's a fairly risky approach, but they won on this one. You don't necessarily win on the others because you're really all the other employers in the city or business in the city don't get that same benefit. They do.
Yeah,
they will.
Just from the fallout.
Let's address this.
I did have something a little bit more specific.
I don't want to run afoul of screwing up a lease and having his effective investment, but he can go through his investment thesis on that.
On page 13, where we have a nice summary of the terms of four, the last item, general partner profits interest. It seems to me this is a classic opportunity for an example. Reading the words, I read them two or three times, and I'll be darned if I can comfortably take a scenario and know quite what I do with it on what it means in a real life scenario. Can you either now or if you need some time on that, not too far down the road, give us an example of how this would actually apply?
We can absolutely build out examples in the future, but I'll tell you right now. Essentially, the way it works is, let's say you commit $100 to the fund. The manager has to invest that money, then return the $100. They have to return the preferred interest rate to the limited partners, so that in this case, that's a 9% compounded rate of return. Then any profits above that $109 for a one-year hold period, they're going to take 20% of the profits above the 9% preferred rate of return. So we get 80% of the profits, they get 20%. The 50-50 catch up there is that they go 50-50 until they've achieved a 20% cumulative, and then it's the 80-20 split beyond
that. So the 50-50 is against the 80-20.
Yeah, so it's like we get the $100 back, we get the $9 back. For every incremental dollar beyond that, we split them 50-50 until they've achieved a 20% total, and then it's 80-20 above that.
I guess what I would encourage going forward is something that goes exactly down the path you just described with perhaps two columns. Column one is us, column two is general partner. Here's the scenario, yep. Invest 100, end of year one, sell. We actually got 200. Here's how the monies are allocated.
That's a great suggestion. We can build out a very good illustrative example there.
Okay.
So last Last comment on Scott, your question. This is interesting because what we heard from the Torchlight Conference is that this time around, the fuel on the real estate boom is actually not a lot of debt money like what we had before the crisis. It's the equity money. So equity money is more sticky because when the times go bad, they don't have to be forced to sell. So this is what we heard from Torchlight.
Interesting. And it's different equity money. Like the New York market, those guys tell me that it's the international money, right, yeah, that just bids the heck out of the prices there, whereas a different dynamic altogether in San Francisco.
And that's part of the diversification, right? You're going to have local drivers in every market that are going to be completely different from one another. It's, yeah. The LA market is going to have a different international influence than the New York market. The Boston market is going to be relatively insular. San Francisco is going to be a tech-centric market. So you can build a diversified portfolio of background drivers as well.
At Torchlight, they mentioned a lot of the Chinese are coming in, buying up in New York. So you're saying they're not interested in San Francisco? That we're as interested, I should say?
You have to look at the relative significance of you have organic economic growth in each one of these markets, then you have foreign buyers coming in for various reasons. My examples there would just be like picking off what do you see as the headline driver. You're going to have 20 different economic drivers below that, but what's the big one driving the marginal purchase? So who's going to be setting the next high point in leasing, that sort of thing?
I remember years ago when the hot spot for international for foreign countries was Hawaii, mainly Japan. I mean, they bought everything left, right, and down the middle. And I just heard that New York may be the hot spot for. It was just bought. The Waldorf Astoria was just bought by a Chinese firm. That's a big generality. But is New York the kind of the hot spot for international coming over? And
New York and London tend to attract the most international capital. I mean, these are the big global centers of commerce and banking, okay. Law, government. So those two do tend to take the bulk of the large oligarch flows and sovereign wealth flows. But there's, we see significant foreign investor money coming into the Los Angeles market now. It's not necessarily coming from China. It's not necessarily coming from Russia. A lot of it was coming from South Korea, their sovereign wealth fund. Singapore has been active. Their sovereign wealth fund has been active. And they did Boston recently. And, I mean, it's spread around a little bit more.
Okay.
It's kind of sound like whoever is doing the investing, what they like. Like right now, San Francisco sort of got the techie thing going. New York maybe have... That kind of what you're saying, how they're comfortable or what they believe the best investment will be, how the future is going to play out.
Yeah, and I think maybe our examples here might have overplayed the thesis a little bit, but I guess what we're looking at is we have organic growth going on. Economic activity is bubbling up in the U.S. It's not at the trend line we want to see. It's not the trend line we had over the past 20 years, but there is economic growth in the United States. That's going to lead to rental growth if we don't have oversupply of rental properties. Especially a core stabilized, nice building, great location, nothing wrong with it. You can step right in and be up and running. There's going to be demand for that. What could potentially increase the returns of these marginal drivers? So sovereign wealth funds coming in, wanting to deploy their capital into U.S. real estate. A booming tech industry, moving things along faster than normal. So we're seeing a better than typical operating environment right now for value add because we're able to sell into the core at inflated values. And so our big question is if the core market deflates to its historical trends, can we still make money?
Right.
And that's what we're underwriting here, and we're saying yes. And I think the managers right now are probably saying, we think we can get high teens returns. Say, that's great, but that depends on a lot of things going right. Let's say a couple things go wrong. What does it look like? Can we still get to low teens and a low teens return? A low double digits return, maybe even a high single digits return in real estate, meets our expectations for the asset class and meets our goals of moving the entire plan forward to meeting the actuarial rate of return.
And that's a great segue to this.
As you said, I'm a lot less intrigued with competing with sovereign funds because of the bubble, I think, that is there. We saw what happened with Japan. Yeah, they went to Hawaii. They also bought Pebble Beach. And then they've been in a 20-year slump ever since. They don't own Pebble Beach anymore, and they probably don't own half the Hawaiian assets. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that New York is going to be, if that's true, if that's a generalization we can make about competing with sovereign funds, China makes me a little bit nervous. I don't care about competing with China on real estate because I think they've got so many see-through buildings in China right now that I'm not sure why they're buying so many in the United States that could conceivably become see-through. And I think tech in California, this is a different bubble to me. I could be entirely wrong, but this one seems like one that's not going to burst real soon. There's an awful lot of tech stuff. There's so much steel coming out of the ground in San Francisco. It's amazing.
Yeah, and let me just address your comment there. We're not necessarily competing with tech money on the acquisition side. We're not necessarily competing with sovereign wealth money on the acquisition side. The big pools of capital around the world that are coming to the United States are generally buying the core stabilized piece of property, and they're not buying it in a fund. Mm-hmm. They're buying it outright, and they're holding it in perpetuity, which matches their liability stream perfectly. I mean, these are long, enduring pools of money. They want to throw off cash for the next couple centuries. By all means, buy the trophy asset that's fully leased, up and running. What we're saying right now is it's an advantageous time to be selling into that market to create that property for them, to deliver something to them. Mm-hmm. So we have that driver. We also have the fixed income crossover folks who say, I'm not getting enough on my core fixed income or my short duration fixed income investments. It's not throwing off the income stream that I need to meet my goals. Where else can I find an income stream? And you're getting the crossover buyers there. So it's a particularly advantageous time. It was even more advantageous a couple years ago, but the prices have come up. What we're looking at this is saying, if we damp down a couple of those drivers, do we still have a decent exit? And the answer is yes. It's not going to be a high teens return. Mm-hmm. But if I can get to a 10% rate of return, and on Chi-Chi's chart here, with a relatively less amount of operational and market risk.
Take it all day.
Yeah. So if we look at the value add franchise in Invesco, before Fund 1 and Fund 2, they have been doing this since 1992. So they have a record of over $4 billion of capital invested in more than 120 transactions. And the most current IRR, not the projection, but the most current IRR is 15% growth, 1.5 multiple. So that is the good number that we are looking at.
Is that $4 billion just in the value-added space?
Yeah. That's in value added.
So they
separate between, accounts.
Yeah, between their funds and separate accounts.
Yeah.
So that's the thing with Invesco, you're buying into a massive real estate organization. Value add is actually the smallest segment. We're in the smallest segment of the real estate organization here. But you can draw upon the resources of the rest of the firm in terms of acquisitions, property management, that sort of thing.
They're about number 5 in the world in real estate investment.
Yeah.
Worldwide.
Yeah. And like what Tim said, it's relatively small in a big organization, but we spoke to them, value add is important for them because most of their assets are in REITs or core where they cannot participate with a lot of upside. These are management fee only vehicle, but this franchise is the one that they can participate. So this is very important for them to do well. And lastly, the fee is on invested capital only. So let's probably sum it up.
So I'm sorry. I just, this whole subject fascinates me. So that Invesco's core holdings are the other side of its own house that's the natural buyer for its value add
yep.
investments? Is that?
And they can't buy from the value add funds.
Okay.
But they're looking at their peers and they're saying, when I'm out there in a core capacity, I know I'm competing against these other players. I've seen what the other core funds are buying. I've seen what other sovereign wealth funds are buying, what strategics are buying, what they're paying. So they've got a fairly good indication of what the exit market looks like.
Yeah, I was just thinking, you know, I guess in an ideal world, you'd have this fully integrated firm that simply bought and sold amongst its segments, and life would be
good. There's a law against that.
There's a problem with that, but interesting.
Yeah, we wouldn't have to pay so much on fees.
I'm sure they could do it with disclosures, everything would be.
Some lawyer would figure it out.
Those advisory committee meetings would be a lot longer than they are today.
Yeah. I think we had a good discussion. Any more questions before we introduce them?
We've also underwritten this.
So basically, your presentation coupled with their presentation today is our consideration about investing in the next fund, which is four.
Correct? Yeah, fund four.
And we would be, the exit I noticed on one is next year. Is that when we would roll?
Yeah.
I'll use the term roll over. I'm sure there's much more significant term into that fund. Or do we have other money that we're thinking of putting in for?
Right now we're talking about other money, anticipated money that's, we go out to all our managers and get cash flow projections. What do you think you're going to sell over the next 6 months? What do you think you're going to sell? And we don't, hold them to it, but it's, you know, give us some guidance.
So we have some money out here.
So
we're not depending on fund one to fund four.
Right, nope.
That's all.
So we look at what we have invested in public REITs with Adelante and Invesco. And then we basically say, you know, we can draw that down. And then what do we expect to get back from our other real estate managers? And that's where we come up with our budget that we presented about a month ago. They came up with our number there. I think we're probably going to overshoot on our returns.
What do you mean by that?
I think the managers are going to return more capital than they're projecting. Our conversations with our managers, it's sounding like there's going to be an abundance of properties hitting the market over the next 6 months. So if anything, we're going to have additional capital beyond what we underwrote here. We always want to remain on the conservative side.
Of course.
Okay, keep going.
I got to get more. I need to understand. I don't know. There are breaks of saying
Yeah, that's true. That's right.
I can't figure out where those lines are.
Yeah.
And there's only a limited amount of it around. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
It's fascinating. I just can't get my arms around it yet.
That's true.
Good point.
Yeah, that's true. Good point. That's true.
Where is this?
Hi, Deb.
That's my first question. Yeah.
My building's been value-added.
No, it's not.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
I know you're pretty familiar with that one.
So this is kind of like the first day of school. Tim and Chi-Chi have written a memo, and they probably discussed this with you. Their recommendation is to invest $35 million into your fund four. So it's kind of like the first day of school where you're starting with an A. So the only way you can go is down. So the floor is yours.
Well, I was taught a very long time ago that when someone makes a recommendation to give you money, you leave the room.
That's right. Well, thank you.
But I don't think you're going to let us do that.
No.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here as always. Always a privilege to be here. Let us quickly introduce ourselves. And we're here, obviously, to give you guys an update on everything that we do for you guys on the direct real estate side of the business. So you guys are invested with us in Value Added Fund 1, 2, and 3, and then obviously we'll talk to you about Fund 4 going forward. For those of you who I don't know, I'm Max Swango. I'm one of the founding partners at Invesco Real Estate. I've been with the company for more than 26 years, and now I've done multiple things for the company, but for the last 13 or 14 years, I have run the global client side of our business, so making sure our clients are very well taken care of. And Jay?
Great, and good to be back here as well. Jay Hurley, I'm the portfolio manager on our series of closed-end value-added funds, also long in the tooth at Invesco. Been here about 20 years, and so glad to be here, and thanks for having us.
Kevin?
Yep. Kevin Conroy, been with Invesco for about 4 years. I work with Jay as a portfolio analyst, and working with him for the past 3 years. Before that, I was in the commercial banking industry, so appreciate you having us here.
So Jay has been running our closed-end series of value-added funds for a long time. Many of you know a gentleman by the name of Dan Kubiak. Dan was Jay's first assistant for the funds up until about a year ago. Mm-hmm. And we actually promoted Dan. Dan now runs a new open-ended direct real estate fund focused on income-oriented investments, more core income-oriented assets. So Dan still sits with the portfolio management team. He's a great resource for them. We actually sent Dan today to meet to do a value-added fund meeting with one of your LP partners, San Antonio Fire and Police. They have an annual real estate meeting because the three of us wanted to be here, and somebody had to go to San Antonio, so we sent Dan to San Antonio. So he still does some work for the funds, but his primary goal is working on the income fund. Kevin was on the team, and we promoted Kevin up into Dan's spot. So like we always try to do, we're always trying to promote from within and create opportunities within the firm, and it's been a great place for us to be, and that's why we've had such low turnover within the firm for so many years. So, but we want to get Kevin here so that you can meet him. And Chi-Chi's had a lot of experience working with Kevin over the last year or so. And we wanted you guys to have a chance to meet Kevin as well. Okay? Okay, so you guys all have the presentation book. And we're going to try to get through this fairly quickly. But please stop us if anything's interesting and ask questions or comments along the way so that we make sure that we're covering what you guys want us to. Tab one is an executive summary, pages 4 and 5. It just summarizes what we're here to talk about, obviously. Valued Fund 4, a $500 million equity target for that fund. A quick update on that fund. We do have 5 commitments for the fund already for $140 million. There are another 5 institutional investors that are either in documentation or in a very similar place to where you guys are. That coincidentally is for another $140 million that we would expect to all be in a position to close before year end. So we would expect to have $280 million closed by year end for Fund 4. There is another $75 million right behind that, even actually a little bit more, but call it 75 conservatively, of existing investors who are going to re-up, we believe, in the first quarter. So. Very strong visibility on at least $350, maybe even $400 million of capital for Fund 4, and that will give us through June 30th, the final close will be June 30th, to get to the $500 million total target for Fund 4.
Max, is R35 part of the 75?
It is part. I put that in the second 140.
Second one, okay.
The second 140.
Okay. That's where I put it.
We are very proud of the organization, and so we say strong institutional sponsorship. We're one of the leading global institutional real estate managers with $61 billion of assets under management. We've grown a lot since you guys hired us first back in 2005, and that has it's really paid dividends for our clients. I mean, obviously we're biased, but. I can tell you that in the 26 years I've worked for Invesco, I've never felt better about the organization. I mean, and I'm just a broken record because every year it's true. I mean, as we've been able to grow the business, we've been able to retain our best talent and, importantly, attract better talent than we ever could have imagined, so which is what you guys want. So when you go visit us around the U.S. or even outside the U.S. and you meet our team in New York City or you meet our team in San Francisco or Newport Beach, it's just we have some of the best acquisitions people sourcing investment opportunities, some of the best underwriters, and some of the best asset managers taking care of the portfolio. So very, very strong platform. Obviously, we wouldn't be here. Staff wouldn't have us here if we didn't have a successful long-term value-added track record. We always talk about strong alignment of interest. Invesco and us individually invest right alongside of you all. Just we have in every fund, and we will again in Fund 4. So we're investing our own capital, personal and corporate, right alongside you all. Attractive pipeline, Blaine. Jay will talk more about. And then again, you know, we're just very proud of the platform and the deal flow that our platform generates is obviously very important. There's only 2 pages in tab 2 to give you, for those of you who don't know Invesco, I'll just spend a quick amount of time or just a quick refresher. The important thing about our parent company is really is the stable platform that they have provided since 1990. They actually bought us 24 years ago in 1990, and when they did, they were a stock and bond management company that wanted to offer their clients real estate, so we did that. And they were very clear from the very beginning. They said, you guys are the real estate experts, and we're going to do everything for you that you don't want to do. So the legal and the compliance and the HR and the IT and all of those things, and they do all of that, and they leave us alone to be real estate experts. It's been a wonderful, wonderful platform in place for us to be, and they continue to be that way. And just like the real estate company, it's better than it's ever been, the parent company is. And the team, the senior team that runs it, is just outstanding. And obviously, there's so much focus on alternative investments today. And having a strong real estate team is very, very important to the parent company. So they're very supportive of what we're doing. It is a New York, publicly traded New York Stock Exchange company. It is in the S&P 500, and it's a global firm, clearly. And then the last most important thing is it's investment management only. So the company is not in the insurance business. It's not in the investment banking. It's not a bank. So all we do is worry about maximizing the performance for our clients. We're not in any other business. It's wonderful. Page 8 shows the real estate firm. You see where we have offices, where we have real estate people around the world. In the four major lines of business, you all are invested with us in North America Direct, which is our oldest since 1983, and our largest, or actually now it's our second largest business. Our largest business now is actually our global real estate securities business, which you are also invested with us in. We manage your non-U.S. REIT portfolio. And that has been a very successful team as well. And then we also have European and Asian direct real estate investments. Okay. So that's the firm update. I'm going to start tab 3, and then I'm going to hand it over to Kevin to finish. Page 10, there's a lot of numbers on the page, but to simplify it for you, these are your investments with us in funds, Value Fund 1, 2, and 3. And in dark gray at the bottom, a potential investment into Fund 4. If you look at, and so we've shown you contributions before 2014 and distributions before 2014 for each fund, and then what we expect for each calendar year. So if you add up 2014, if you add up all those numbers by the end of this year, actually we expect to give you another $10 million in distributions between today and the end of the year. And after we've done that, between all three funds, we will have roughly $33 million invested with us between all three funds. And if you add up the columns in the 2015 column, you'll see that we, through selling assets, we expect to return to you another $52 million in 2015. So funds 1, 2, and 3 are basically in liquidation mode. So $33 million invested as of the end of the year, returning another $52 million to you in 2015, which is the reason for Value Fund 4 now, is so that we can keep exposure to the Invesco Value Added Fund series. And you can see what allocating $35 million to Fund 4 would do to you. The bottom line shows you what your total exposure would be to us. So at the end of this year, if you invest in Value Fund 4, roughly $40 million with us, going down to $37 million. So some of the sales are offset by some capital calls into Fund 4. So that's sort of the capital flow summary. And then I will let Kevin give you a quick summary on Funds 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Max. So I'll just give you guys some quick talking points on these next three slides. We'll start with Fund 1, 2005 Vintage Fund. We raised $320 million, invested that. In that time frame, went through the GFC there, as you can see. We are in the process of liquidating the fund. We invested 15 assets. We have one remaining. We're looking to exit that out by the end of 2015, get you guys your capital back and in profit as well. So that kind of goes over Fund 1. We'll flip to Fund 2. Very similar story. 2007 Vintage Fund, there's $450 million, 16 investments in this fund. Half were kind of pre-GFC, half post-GFC. The ones post-GFC have done very well. We have six remaining investments, and we're looking, as similar to Fund 1, we're looking to liquidate those over the next 15 months. As you can see, the two pictures here are two of the remaining investments, Highland Park in Washington, D.C., Hennepin in Minneapolis. Those are both actually in the market getting bids on Hennepin today, so hopefully we'll transact on that by the end of the year and get you guys some capital back there. Again, return capital with some profit in 15 is the projection here. Next slide is Fund 3. It's a 2012 vintage fund, raised $340 million. We are finishing up the acquisition process there. Got two deals that we're looking to close on by the end of the year. And we are beginning to liquidate the first investments we made in that fund, looking to liquidate 3 to 4 investments in the next 6 months. Three of those we're trying to transact by the end of the year to get you guys capital back, keep you kind of at the 60% net invested while being fully committed to 93-95%. Strong projected performance. We are looking to, you know, lock in some of that performance here in the next 6 months, as I said. As you see at the bottom, it's a 2019 maturity. We're looking to be out fully by 17 and close the fund.
So you expect the buying power of the market to remain as strong and robust then as it is now?
In it's a capital flow question, really. Yeah. There is, one of the reasons that we like value-added investing today is because there is so much capital chasing core assets. And so our strategy is to buy broken assets, fix them, turn them into core assets, and there's a tremendous amount of capital, as you mentioned, that wants to buy those core assets. So it's one of the reasons that's driving very, very good performance for funds, for all of these funds today. Do we expect that to continue? It's a very difficult question to answer. I mean, there are basically two things that drive performance going forward: in real estate fundamentals and the capital markets. And you're asking about the capital markets. The real estate fundamentals is what we're very good at doing, predicting supply and demand, and where do we buy and where do we sell and what property types and all that. And real estate fundamentals are very, generally speaking, every property type and every market's different, but generally speaking, real estate fundamentals are very strong. The capital markets are also, as you mentioned, very strong today as well. Significant capital flows. Predicting the future of capital flows is like predicting interest rates. It's very difficult to do, but there are lots of things that allow us to sleep at night, like alternative investments are very popular today, and you can barely go a day without reading in the press somewhere, P&I or any kind of press, that more and more investors are increasing their allocations to alternative investments. And within alternative investments, real estate is typically the largest piece. So yes, we are continuing to see your peers around the world increasing their allocations and their targets to real estate, which is one of the things that's driving all of this capital flow to real estate that you mentioned. It's your peers in the U.S., the public pension funds in the U.S., it's the pension funds outside the U.S., it's the sovereign wealth funds outside the U.S., it's retail capital, it's individual investors investing into REITs and other kinds of retail-oriented investments. So, yes, we feel, based on what we see in the market, there's no slowdown in capital coming to real estate. It's just interest rates are so low that investors are looking for ways to get income. They're nervous about the volatility in the stock market. They don't like fixed income because interest rates are so low. So real estate is very, very popular. And it just every time I turn around, there's another, you know, there's another $300 billion sovereign wealth fund or Taiwanese pension fund that I'm actually going to visit on Friday that has zero allocation to real estate. And they want to go to 5, which is $15 billion. I mean, there's strong demand for the asset class that I think, it's not going to go like this. It's going to be, but I think it'll be more 10 years from now than it is.
The question I have coming off of his is, the supply, I mean, do you still think that the supply is going to be there? Are you still going to be able to find, and I know you guys are good at it because you've been doing it, but are you still going to be able to find it when the money is there and people are just, they're starting to buy it all up? What's going to be left for you?
Yeah. Well, it is what you pay us to do. Mm-hmm. There's no question. And, yep. and we've got to have great people in the markets doing that, which we think we do. But I also fall back. It drives me crazy when our acquisition guys tell me how competitive the market is, because it is always competitive. Mm-hmm. Always. In 1995, when there was significantly less capital, it was very competitive. I mean, there was not a deal that Jay and I used to take deals to investment committee 20 years ago, that the investment committee would just, you know, wring their hand. It was crazy trying to get a deal approved. It's always, always hard.
Best way to sum it up is you're not going to invest just to invest.
We're not.
No question.
We're not. It's we're not going to invest to invest. And one of the nice things about us is that we have this nice platform, so we don't have to force capital into the market to keep the lights on and pay our staff. We're only going to invest if we think for performance. If we think we can have good performance. Now, having said that, I personally am not. And we do debate this, and there's a range of people on our committees. I personally do not believe that you can time the markets. I think that I've seen too many cycles, and I remember 2002 when everybody thought that real estate was overpriced and you should be selling everything. And if you had bought in 2002 and sold any time between 2002 and 2008, you would have made a fortune. So you just cannot time the markets. And so what I do believe in is buying through the cycles. And I think that if you look at, and I don't want to steal yep. Jay's thunder, but if you look at page 15, we predicted for all of our funds, we had projected returns in the 10 to 14% range for all of our funds. And lesson learned, I mean, that we all probably knew before, the returns are not going to be 10 to 14. In Value Fund 4, we're predicting 10 to 14. They're not going to be 10 to 14. In Fund 1, they were 2. In Fund 3, they were 8. I'm sorry. In Fund 1, they were 2. In Fund 2, they were 8. And in Fund 3, they were 22. So you invest through the cycle, and after 15 years, you get to your 10 to 14, as long as you don't skip a fund. Because, you know, investor mentality a lot of times is, I invested in the 2 and I invested in the 8 and I'm going to skip fund 3 and you missed the 22.
Right.
You know, fortunately you guys invested in fund 3 at the very last minute. And
now you're going to give it back.
But you did invest. So you got the 22.
Yep.
Well, knock on wood, it's not done yet, but it's looking very good. It's looking very good. So I don't think Fund 4 is not going to be the moral. Fund 4 is not going to be 10 to 14. It might be. But if you invest in funds 1 through 10, I'll bet you end up in the 10 to 14 range.
Yeah, I don't know how you, I guess, well, you don't avoid the cycle. I mean, it just seems to me, I had someone a whole lot smarter than me after I first got on the board explain to me or say to me that the single overarching consideration in real estate is basis.
Basis.
Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, that's the most important fundamental thing. Mm-hmm. And so in a climate of ever increasing basis, as you're chasing the deal that you're going to add value to and flip it at some point,
yeah.
if the market, you know, if the capital market softens, there's nowhere to go. Right?
Yeah, I didn't realize you were paying that close attention to me.
Nice guy down there. Gabe's been so important.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no question. It's one of the most important things.
Yeah.
Basis is one of the most important things we look at, and we have property write-ups in here, and I'll bet in most of the property write-ups it references basis relative to replacement cost. Because replacement, what it would cost to build it new, is a sort of a benchmark, good benchmark for the industry. And so, you know, for example, we've already bought one investment in Fund 4. It's in San Francisco. It's an office building, and we bought it for $550 or something.
Yeah, $500.
$500 per square foot, and to build new would cost you at least $800 per square foot. So it is one of the most important things that we look at. Now, having said that, basis there is inflation, and so the cost to build new buildings goes up. Cost of land, the cost of land in downtown San Francisco is a lot more than it used than it was. Pick a year, 2000, 2001.
Yesterday.
Exactly. Yesterday. And the cost of labor and the cost of materials and these things all go up. And so I it would be very interesting, but it, you know, to go back and look at some of the buildings that we bought 20 years ago and what the basis was and what they would cost. So basis, again, similar. Basis doesn't go like this. It does cycle. And we have to be very careful about it, and we watch it, especially relative to replacement cost.
So the answer is we should invest in every fund, just like you do payroll deductions every cycle, and just keep investing in the market, dollar cost average, and you'll come out with,
we'll come out with
decent returns.
Averaging in and not trying to outsmart the market. I just don't know. And hopefully you hire really good investment managers who you trust, who can actually add alpha, and who have the ability to source interesting investment opportunities.
But you can't skip a fund. You might miss out on the 22,
I know,
right?
That yeah. was my biggest
might miss out on the 22.
We have. Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. There are investors who are in funds 1, 2, and 4.
Because they learned that they didn't go into 3, and they don't want to miss it out the next time, and they realize, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, in non-core returning vehicles like this, I think that is true. If it was core, you know, there's a little more less volatility, but I think Max's point is good. In non-core sort of higher yielding strategies, I think it's absolutely true.
So, well, so let me turn it.
Yeah, sure. Why don't we? We'll go quickly through track record. Max has hit on some of this, but we've been investing without. Stepping away from the space for 22 years in the value-added space that represents about $9 billion. So we've seen it all, the good, the bad, and the ugly, multiple cycles. The benefit there as an LP in our funds is the fact that we have seen it all, and we've, you know, hopefully, incrementally, we have a strategy we believe in, and around the edges, the lessons learned help us to, you know, continue to refine that to greater outcomes. As you can see here, all assets over that 22-year period in the aggregate, about a 13.5% return. If you then look at those that have just sold, so have actually been realized, the return's a little bit better at 15. And most importantly, which we're really focused on, whether in a fund wrapper or in a separate account wrapper, we have never had a realized capital loss at the vehicle level. So we're very cognizant of protecting your capital in that regard. The question we get a lot of times in the value-added space is, well, gosh, how do you guys give context to your performance? How do you benchmark it? And the short answer is it's very difficult. In the core space, there's a very well-accepted benchmark called Odyssey that works really well. Differently in the value-added space, there are several groups that try to provide indices for vintage years. It's not been accepted. No index has been broadly accepted yet. So what we try to give you on page 16 is to take all three of our funds, take a sampling of what today is the largest groups trying to produce indices for you to give you some relative context. All this needs to have an asterisk around it because there are lots of issues around survivor bias. You're not compelled to put your data in. So if you have poor performance, you're not going to submit data. So you have that issue. You have different valuation policy built in. So we put a big asterisk around this page just so you sort of know how much weight to put on here. But I think the takeaway is moving left to right. These are the sampling of benchmarks for Fund 1, 2, and 3. And what you see here is essentially an increasing performance trend. So second quartile in Fund 1, kind of a second quartile, top quartile in 2, and then pretty demonstrated top quartile performance in 3. So to me, the takeaway here as an LP looking at our fund series is good performance, but actually the trend on performance is that we're trending in the right direction to top quartile as well. Again, you know, with the caveats that I've talked about related to some of the shortcomings of the indices. Probably as important on the next slide, what we try to give you for funds 1 and 2, this really is a repatriation of capital back against the broader markets. Our distribution back of capital is the red dotted line against the various quartile rankings of a peer group set. And all we're trying to show here is we are very cognizant of trying to get your capital to drive excess performance, but also to get your capital back to you through once we've accomplished that performance, so we're not being slow or lagging in a repatriation of capital.
Jay, value added is kind of a vague term. I mean, it's what an investor or a developer or a fund manager wants it to be or defines it themselves. Have you noticed or have you kind of changed your definition of value added? I mean, value added, pure value added is you buy an asset that needs some cosmetic type fixing up, maybe increase rents and move on. Whereas you go down to opportunistic, it may have some more issues, you go down to distress, it has financing issues as well as performance issues. Have you seen a broadening of this definition of value added to kind of move more downstream to seek greater returns?
So I think there's, you know, as there's more competitive capital in the market and returns start to come in. So Fund 3, we're looking at outsized returns to normalize value returns, as Max alluded to. As that starts to come in and normalize a bit more to Fund 4, the tendency is for some people to try to push risk to go drive more return. That's not what you're signing up for if you sign up with us. Let me just tell you that. So the lead in there really goes to the next section to try to define it.
And let me give a quick overview. The next section is Jay's going to define what value added means to us. And I give Jay a lot of credit. He and his team have spent a lot of time looking back, testing our history and saying, okay, what do we do really well and what do we do not so well? And let's not do this stuff that we don't do very well. And let's focus a lot on what we do really, really well. And that's what Jay is about to describe.
But before we leave page 17, relative performance for return of capital, is it a good thing to get that capital quickly? Everything equal, wouldn't you want to keep earning those returns longer rather than shorter?
Yeah. Well, our view is that a lot of our definition is, Bob, is we're always looking that on a forward basis, we're reprojecting what the forward return of an asset is. And most of the time what happens is we create value, so you get a quick ramp up in value, and then you flatten out, so you get more of a core profile going forward. If that's the case, it's a sell signal to return capital. So that's largely what's behind this. We don't want to hold your capital in a forward core return sort of environment, because it's not what you've signed up for.
And you can always re-up for the next fund.
Right. So, Brian, a little bit to your question. So we really look at a couple styles of investing in value added. One is going to be the majority of what we do, and in round figures, it's going to be 3/4 roughly of the exposure of any fund that we do in this series. And that's this idea that Max alluded to earlier of broken core, as we like to call it, which is we want to buy a fundamentally core piece of real estate that at the point we enter it has a tactical deficiency that we can remediate with expertise at the asset level, to your point, leasing, renovation, redevelopment, those sorts of asset level execution and or capital infusion to reposition the asset. So the reason we do that is exactly this idea of market cycle, and nobody can completely call a market cycle, but what we can do is we can hedge as best as possible to movements in cap rates through the market cycle by having a core asset come out at the end of the day, at the end of the remediation process. Because what we do know, and have back-tested, is at any point in a capital market cycle, core capital is the most durable, so it's always there, liquidity, and it's always the most aggressively priced on a relative basis to where you may be. So we can hedge by producing and fixing broken core and selling it back into the core market as a hedge against market cycle movement. And so as a consequence, we think that's the best risk-adjusted strategy, and it's the one that we will build, again, about 3/4 of the exposure of what we do. We'll have that investment style to it. Some of the description of what that means is at the bottom of these overweights. So it's going to be non-commodity assets, it's going to be gateway markets, predominantly multifamily and urban office from a sector point of view. Those are long wave trends that core capital stays with throughout a market cycle. So it's a great hedge to liquidity and to exit pricing for us. So we like that. That'll be the predominant exposure that we take. The other on a minority basis is we do operate in a private asset class. And again, this idea of basis, you guys went right to it, is at certain points in a market cycle, there are opportunities in a private market that we operate in where there are just mispricing opportunities that we can go be opportunistic to and to acquire assets there. Those typically don't, most likely are not going to be gateway markets. Those markets tend to be a little too efficient. They're going to be a little bit more commodity in nature to get that more aggressive basis. But there are times when we can access distressed sellers or sellers that need to recapitalize under a non-market valuation basis that we could be opportunistic to.
But on that investment, you don't consider that distressed real estate. That's a value-added opportunity.
That's value-added because we're not buying flawed real estate. We're buying real estate that's not trading at full market value. And to us, that's a big distinction. We're not buying flawed real estate that has no way to compete and move and draw tenants to it. That's a non-starter.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get my arms around
that. Would be, you know, there are some, you know, a lot of the opportunity fund space is in this idea of buying a big pool of flawed stuff, and you know that 75% you're going to lay off and 25% maybe is where you make your money. We're buying fundamentally functional real estate at a pricing level that is a discount to market.
Okay, so a distressed seller isn't distressed property.
No. Distressed properties are red line. We're not buying something that we know we can't bring expertise to and actually drive NOI growth. We're not signing up for that.
Okay. I'm trying to understand the
it's a great
it sounds to me like value added to you can be a diamond in the rough kind of situation, or it's the one I think that's in our packet that at $551 a foot.
Yep.
It's a great building. It's just under leased, and you
yeah.
happen to have
a
magical tenant.
It's a
right?
functional building.
And
right.
you come in and with Mr. New Tenant, and all of a sudden
that's right.
it's doing gangbusters,
it is
right?
New Tenant, too.
The distinction would be on basis, because you went to that. It's a great question. Is there are some pieces of real estate that are cheap for a reason, and they're cheap
right.
on basis because they're just not functional, right? They have some obsolescence characteristics to them that they will never be able to move the needle on growing NOI growth. Those are non-starters. I don't care how cheap that real estate is. That's not what we do. It's not our style. We don't believe in it.
Okay.
Jay, do you have any models or examples in the Bay Area that meet this test of being an unacceptable investment?
That's a great question.
An unacceptable
Bay Area
would be flawed to the point that you would not it would not meet a ultimate
mm-hmm.
core test mm-hmm. and saleability in what you're looking for.
Yeah.
I'm just
not by specific asset, but there are attributes of certain assets. So if you think of industrial properties, or certain bay depths and clear heights and some of these characteristics to the building make them obsolescent to actually attracting tenants. So those are redlined kinds of ideas. Some office markets, you know, could be the depth of the window line, could be the ceiling height that we wouldn't participate because we don't think those are functional to the tenant demands in the market. Things like the attributes of the asset really would be what would redline you out.
And you don't look for scrapers ever, sounds like.
No, because we're not land speculating, and if we do development, we like to call it shovel ready. It's we sign up for a development on Friday and we break ground on Monday, kind of an idea. We're not value added risk doesn't sort of venture into land speculation.
Okay.
It's more opportunistic.
Your returns really come from two sources. One is buying value added, selling core.
Yes.
And the other is buying value added and the value of value added going up while you own it.
Yes.
How does your value creation or returns divide between those two sources?
Yeah, I'd say we've done the attribution around this. Again, short holds, you can look at it on an income appreciation sort of vantage point. So the attribution is going to be 50 to 80% appreciation. Part of that is, right, we're holding short, so you don't have a long income element to it. And we're trying to get into something that's not ambiguous, fix it at the asset level, lease it and sell it. So it is we're trying to have a very definable 2 to 3 year execution and move on through. So I don't know that that's maybe directly answering your question, but it is an appreciation oriented investment style. So then quickly, a little bit just to finish the thought around a definition on page 20, the three columns here, these are really, I would say if you had another manager in, there's probably a slide that looks very similar to this in most package and most presentations that you look at. So traditional value added is the middle column here, re-tenanting, renovation, redevelopment. So we're going in and fixing something at the asset level and selling it. We really don't go into a fund with a pre-specified allocation among these strategies. We really allow the best relative value on each next incremental dollar to make the decision. But if I had to say, broadly speaking, what you could think of us is about two-thirds sort of traditional value-added exposure will be that middle column, re-tenanting, renovation, repositioning. Recapitalization, again, is the idea we can go in and either a lender will sell at a discount or an equity partner wants out a discount. Some discount angle is sort of this recapitalization idea. Candidly, to your point now, where the market is, those are going to be harder to find because the market's pretty flush with capital. So the distress angle in the market is not pronounced at the moment, so probably 10%. And then we'll do about 25% development, but the attributes there are going to be urban, transit-oriented, amenity-rich, employment-dense, and they're going to be almost exclusively multifamily. And the reason, again, to the multifamily bent is it's really a hedge against capital market movement because that property type in all parts of the market cycle is highly liquid. So we're going to hedge in that direction. Page 21 really is just a summary graphically of what I've talked about, so I think we can probably move beyond that, but it gives you a snapshot of what you should expect from a various set of exposures by sector allocation, market selection, projected returns, and investment pace. This gives you a blueprint of what you should hold us to when we come back and sit down with you in terms of where we put capital to work in various exposures.
Jay, one other quick question while you're on all this. Construction companies are just critical to doing all this
in
some controlled manner. I've got modest experience in this. Do you have favored companies?
We do.
In all of your key markets?
We do. The benefit of our platform is we're only working with the top tier operating partners in markets, to your point. The other thing is we are very aggressive in our joint venture documentation to push anything that looks like construction risk, the economic risk, onto that partner and off of the fund. So cost overruns run to our partner, they don't run to us. Guarantees from banks run from the partner to the bank, not from the fund. All those kinds of risks that are not, you know, what we're being paid for on our side of the fence, we push off to our partners, to your point.
Top tier partners, gotta be.
Yeah, has to be.
Okay, into tab 6, page 23 talks about the current market environment, some of which we've talked about today. And I mentioned before, there are two things that will drive performance: fundamentals and the capital markets. And if you think about today, generally speaking, there's very limited new supply, which is good, right? If you're an owner of real estate or an investor in real estate, supply is basically under control. Again, different in every market and for every property type. There's good demand for real estate. So you're saying as the economy is starting to improve, that's creating demand for real estate. And obviously there are certain parts of the economy that are doing better than others. Technology, obviously very good. Energy, very good. Healthcare. There are some things that are driving demand for real estate. And we're going to look for properties and markets that have good demand drivers for property. So when you have limited supply and good demand, you're seeing increasing occupancy. So very, very strong real estate fundamentals. And when you have, it's challenging to invest in value-added properties. You don't want to be building properties. You don't want to be buying empty properties when there's no demand for that space. So given that we're seeing good demand for space, that makes value-added investing feel better today than in tougher economic times.
Max?
Yes?
It says here apartment and industrial deliveries to exceed long-term average rates.
Right.
Does that mean that there will be more supply than
Yeah, well, multifamily, they're right about at long-term average. Just sneaking over the long-term average. And a lot of that is just being driven by pent-up demand because supply has been so low for the last 5 years. So to give you some statistics, we would expect multifamily completions in 2014 to be about 300,000 units, and so that's the long-term, right at the long-term average. And for context, that is what annual demand generally is in this country for apartments. So the new supply is just keeping up with demand. And if you look at our core fund, we have an $8 billion fund, open-ended fund that just buys stabilized existing leased properties, core properties, that has a significant exposure to multifamily. The multifamily portfolio in our core fund, and just use our core fund as a proxy for the universe, is 97% occupied, which is just too high. I mean, it's never been that high. So very, very strong real estate fundamentals that can absorb some of that supply. Mm-hmm. Now, we have to be very careful, because you don't want to go build where there's 15 other apartments. I mean, we try to be first or second. You know, we try to be very careful about our sites where we're building. We want to have unique. Jay talks about non-commodity. We want to have very unique locations. So we have to be careful. And then the capital markets, as you guys I'm sure know, real estate cap rates are lower than they've ever been. So. And I can argue the pros and cons of that, but it is certainly a concern. And so one of the reasons that value-added investing makes some sense today is if you've got real estate cap rates that are about 5%, plus or minus, for core properties, the idea with value-add is that you buy broken core assets, you fix them, and you create a stabilized income return that's significantly higher than that 5% core cap rate. So you're building a core, you're developing or you're creating a core asset that is not at these low 5% cap rates, but is in the more maybe 6 to 7% type range. Okay, and then you sell to that 5 cap rate buyer. Okay, so that's the compelling, that's the market today, the value added market. Okay, there's a list of fund terms on page 24, very similar to funds 1, 2, and 3. We try to be as LP-friendly as we possibly can. You guys who have known us for a long time, I think you know that that's the culture of our business. There is, I think, really just one significant change from Fund 3, and that is the preferred return. So you can see in the distributions line, Funds 1, 2, and 3 all had a, and so let me just talk about the fees for a second. The fees, the total fees to this fund are 1.5% on invested equity. So there are no fees on commitments. It's just once we invest the equity, it's 1.5%. And then that's the only fee. There's no acquisition fees. There's no financing fees. There's no other fees except for that until we get to the incentive fee. The way the incentive fee works is you get all of your capital back, and then you get your preferred return, and then we start to share in an incentive fee. And for funds 1, 2, and 3, that preferred return was 10%. We dropped it for fund 4 to 9 for a couple of reasons. One, basically, it's market. The market for preferred returns is in the 8 to 10% range, and for high-quality firms, it's really in the 9 is standard market. We've had absolutely zero pushback on any of our fees for this fund, so I'm very confident that is the market fee. But the other really compelling reason is to answer some of the questions before, total return expectations have come down in all asset classes, right? And so as real estate return expectations 4 years ago were much higher than they were today for lots of different reasons, and all asset class returns have come down. And so we don't want to be forced to try to do riskier things to try to get to our incentive fee. So we'd much rather continue doing the things that we've done well at lower returns than try to take more risk just to try to get to our incentive fee. So that's why we dropped it. To get in line with market and to just reflect the fact that overall returns have come down across the board, not just in real estate. Okay. Okay, so those are the fund terms. I mentioned, and I know we've been on a lot longer, I mentioned we have done one investment, which is highlighted on pages 25 and 26, and we can talk in as much or little detail with you guys about that. The good news is that we bought this building 70% occupied with significant more lease rollover in the near term. This building is a block and a half from Yelp's world headquarters, and Yelp has come to us and they've executed a lease to take the entire building. Plus, anytime any of the space rolls, they want the space that rolls. So Yelp, there will be no vacancy in this building. The goal, we have to hold assets at least a year for tax reasons. So the goal is to sell this building on day one of year two, and achieve probably a 1.5 multiple, hopefully higher. The fund is off to a great start with that investment. There are actually three other investments that are under agreement. They happen to all be, just based on where we are in the cycle, all multifamily development opportunities. Again, very unique locations. One in Fort Lauderdale, very close to the beach. One in Buckhead in Atlanta, very infill, unique location. And then one in downtown Minneapolis, adjacent to the new Minnesota Vikings football stadium. So with those investments, there's actually a potential fifth that we actually also control, which would be a multifamily rehab in Manhattan with an operating partner that we've done a lot of business together in New York City. He's very, very good at that. So with all those, the fund four could easily be 20-25%, mm-hmm. 20-25% committed with those investments. So I think we're off to a very quick and good start for fund four.
I have a very interesting question. Are these the Alps?
Oh, that's a great question. No, I should know this. I think it's the Himalayas.
The Himalayas. Okay. Yes. That's an interesting metaphor for climbing and reaching the top.
What are those two little guys doing out there on that ledge?
We do actually have some pictures with guys climbing this mountain, and this is one of them.
Oh, yeah, there's like four or five. A quick question
on the San Francisco. Something that came up in our earlier discussion. Is there any sort of, do you look for buildings that might benefit from a resanctioning or a government influence that might lower the basis, kind of for an entry point? This was the case with Twitter, Dice are end of market idea that they would be the anchor tenant in the neighborhood, even,
right,
make the neighborhood more palatable, likely to more foreign investors. Do you ever look at that sort of thing when you're selecting properties?
Well, that one was really driven by the fact that the deal on its own economically could not have been developed without a contribution from the city to make the basis right-sized. So it's not something that we could. It was a development-driven, Twitter-driven, sort of special situation. But we have participated indirectly. We have participated in some developments where cities have thrown in, TIFs or some sort of contribution to sort of sweeten the economics.
It's always something we're looking at. Those tend to be located in pioneering locations that don't really fit with our, what we would typically do. But if we find something like the Twitter location that we believe in, then we've done that in Minneapolis. We talked about that. Mm-hmm. The investments we've made in Minneapolis sometimes have been kind of pioneering. Not quite to the Civic Center San Francisco location, but a little bit pioneering. And you're always trying. Our head of acquisitions is a guy named Greg Krause, and he's an athlete, and he always says we want to go where the puck is going, the ice hockey term. You don't want to go where the puck is today. You want to be where the puck is headed, and so that's what we're always trying to do with our investments, and we've been pretty successful doing that. So. Any other
questions? Gentlemen, as always, thank you very much.
Thank you guys very much. We love being here, so you know where we are.
Where the puck's going.
That's where we want to be.
Yeah.